My guest today is Professor Patrick Vaughan of Jagiellonian University, whom I had the pleasure of meeting many years ago. Actually, I think more than 10 years ago.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, I took Patrick's class, Cold War class, and several other classes, and I enjoyed all of them. And today we want to talk a little bit about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the new Quentin Tarantino film. And usually I wouldn't ever start a conversation like that, but I think this is relevant, and this is why I will ask this question. When were you born and where did you grow up? Because this is very important.
Oh, I don't mind. I was born in 1965 in Seattle, Washington, but I moved quickly in my youth to Bakersfield, California, which is about an hour and a half north of where this incident took place in 1969. So it was very much in the consciousness of where I grew up and amongst my friends and everything like this. It was not an ordinary sort of incident. It was like a modern horror show. And so everybody kind of remembers this. So I wasn't completely happy when I heard Tarantino was doing this film, because I was worried about this a little bit, because this thing has been glamorized in a lot of ways, and that we can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, it was actually glamorized, and sort of the whole Manson family story and the horrific killings at Cielo Drive. When I was researching it a little bit before Tarantino's film opened, I was surprised how quickly it sort of entered this bloodstream of mass culture. I mean, the TV movie with Steve Railsback, Helter Skelter, was made like four years basically after the event. So it was immediate that it became like this pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah, this is kind of what I mean. I mean, I was probably 4 years old when the event actually happened, but within the next 5 years, there was the trial, there was the book Helter Skelter that came out, there were all of these sort of knockoff ideas. The death penalty was rescinded, so that brought it back in the news. So Manson was so much in the news that for me it was disturbing. And I lived in a pretty conservative neighborhood. Most of my friends' fathers, a couple of them were in law enforcement. One was a CHP, California Highway Patrol, and they were talking about this when we were probably too young to understand. And but it was in the bloodstream, as you said. It was in the culture. And kids would talk about it at school. People were talking about Helter Skelter when we were 9 years old. And in the playground, you have to kind of pretend you know what they're talking about.
Right,
but we obviously didn't get everything. And it's just a very complicated topic and a very disturbing topic, I think. Yeah,
yeah, there's also this sort of morbid allure to it all. You know, this sort of occult. And it's a scary story that somehow everyone wanted to hear over and over again. I remember I was shocked, for example, when I discovered, well, actually, these photos were heavily publicized, but, you know, that Polanski posed for some live magazine photos in the house at Cielo Drive soon after all of those, you know, all this horrific carnage happened, you know, with all the evidence still there, with the, you know, horrific blood stains on the walls. So it seems like it was that moment that everybody was even hungry to hear more, you know, like to learn as much as possible about the crimes.
And it makes you a little bit cautious, you know. We've talked about this before, I think, you and I, about films, and I don't like. You obviously have to have a subject matter. Nobody wants to watch a boring film about an accountant going home at 5 o'clock and watching television. You know, so there has to be some subject matter. But in America, there is this morbid curiosity. There was the Charlie Starkweather incident in the late 50s that was made into Badlands.
Yep.
And even when we talk about Tarantino, we can talk about this if you want later, but I was even bothered in the early 90s when Natural Born Killers and these sort of films came up, and there is this morbid curiosity with death or with killing sprees. And I think the Manson one had everything. It had stars. It had Hollywood royalty. If you dig beneath the surface, it's not only Sharon Tate, but it's Doris Day's son. There's Candace Bergen was in there. There's the Beach Boys. It was more than just a couple, you know, really morbid nights in Los Angeles. There was something bigger about it that I think got into the culture, and you could really see. And it was such a strange summer because it happened only 2 weeks after the moon landing, and you could see that even in the headlines in the Los Angeles Times, if you look at it, it said this terrible killing, and in the on the side column it said astronauts coming out of 2 weeks of quarantine. You know, so it's so the events were so packed that summer, and Woodstock was a couple weeks after that. And of course, I think the really end of the 60s was Altamont, this Rolling Stones concert. And if you really want to see, and I was watching the film, and I think it was realistic in a lot of ways. He got the cars right. He got the vibe right. I think the Brad Pitt character was especially good at this sort of late 60s guy who doesn't really care too much. But if you really want to see the vibe of that period, I think you should watch this documentary by the Rolling Stones, Gimme Shelter, which I think is on YouTube. And you can really see how scary it was when people that were on all sorts of pharmaceuticals that should not have been, right, at 9 o'clock in the morning. And you could really see what this does to the society. And it creates chaos. And I think that film, even better than this one, really gives that vibe of just a society being out of control with lots of speed as well. You know, not just, you know, rainbow drugs where people feel like hugging each other. There's a lot of drugs there that make you sort of not a very pleasant person.
Yeah, absolutely. The Meisels Brothers documentary that you mentioned, and you know, which is horrific in another way because it's basically, you know, it features almost a video recording of an actual killing, because this concert, this notorious concert where there was a casualty, the whole Hell's Angels episode, etc. But I think that also the whole moment, as you said, was extremely fraught. 1969 in many different ways. That was also the moment when the first X-rated film got an Oscar for the best picture, which was Midnight Cowboy. It was the first sort of a respectable film to even depict this world of porn theaters in Times Square, and that was sort of a watershed moment, I think. But also, I mean, if you look at the films being released at the time, there are many titles that in many ways would, you know, either violate or at least negotiate some taboos. Like 2 years later, we have Deliverance, for example. There are many, many films that sort of were shocking in some ways, but also that they were touching on subjects that were completely taboo beforehand. And I think that it had to have a effect on society.
Well, I think the thing you have to do, and I think you're getting into Tarantino's wheelhouse there, that where he came of age in this age of, you know, Sam Peckinpah and The Getaway, where you can, you know, do anything you want, whereas 10 years before you couldn't do this. There was such a transition in the way films were made. But the culture was changing. You know, I think one of the things that's important is to know, I show this film in the 60s class. I teach a class on the 60s. It's one of my favorite films. It's called Dogfight. I think it's River Phoenix, one of his last films. But you see how fast the culture changed from when Kennedy was shot in November of 1963. The Beatles landed in New York. 6 weeks later, they have longer hair. That's a cultural revolution right there in and of itself. Then you get Vietnam. Then you get the cultural revolution, the cities, civil rights. And the film industry went right along with that. The culture was moving so fast that I think the films were a little bit behind, but not much, where you had The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, that sort of new Hollywood that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and even though, I mean, because usually there's this fantastic book movies at the Revolution. I don't remember the author now, Mark something. He focuses on 1967, and he said that this was the key year, as you said, Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, but also In the Heat of the Night, and several other titles that were touching upon those controversial issues. But the remarkable thing about the Tarantino film is, I think, and now we can start really discussing, because he basically, there are barely any references to any of the movies that we just mentioned. He focuses on a different nook of Hollywood, I would say, mainly on those TV serials, westerns. And do you have recollections of those shows, like Wanted, Dead or Alive, or The Rifleman, and all the others? Like, what is your recollection of those?
Of course, and you mentioned Midnight Cowboy, and I was too young for that, but I do remember the same year True Grit came out, and I kept thinking about this with the Brad Pitt character that Angelina Jolie's father was in Midnight Cowboy, so I was thinking about that, if this is the same year. But the westerns and TV were predominant in the 1960s, late 50s, early 60s, and they actually stand up pretty well. You know, I'm talking about Gunsmoke, which was Quentin Tarantino's, named after Burt Reynolds' character as a blacksmith. There was High Chaparral was a good one, Bonanza, of course, Big Valley, and you can see a lot of good writing in there. You can see Gene Roddenberry in there, Sam Peckinpah, of course. And I think that a story is a story, so even if it was a Western, I think by 1967, people were just tired of the Westerns. You could even see that in the Tarantino film, where they're kind of,
going through the motions.
Yeah, let's not make him look like a cowboy. Let's make him look like a Hell's Angel. So, but they were good. I think those films stand up pretty well. They obviously were limited in their subject matter, but you could see a lot of it was in allegory, metaphor. And I would take issue with a lot of some of the cliches that says that those were the only good Indian is a dead Indian. You could see that in the Tarantino film, where I think that you could see in the 1960s there was a lot of metaphorical references to the civil rights movement using Indians or Chinese immigration into California, as especially in The Rifleman, where Chuck Connors was always standing up for somebody who was being oppressed by a bully. These were the good guys in these shows were never bullies. Yeah,
that's the absolutely true. And many of the writers on those shows were actually, you know, very conscientious, like liberal writers who wanted to put that more, let's say, enlightened agenda into the shows. Like Sterling Sullivan, for example, who wrote a number of shows, and also he then wrote the script for In the Heat of the Night. So there's this sort of the epitome of Kennedy era Western was, of course, Magnificent Seven, in which you have, you know, this group of guys who are actually standing up for the oppressed, for the minority, for the ethnic minority.
I used to tell my friends the best show on television now is Rifleman, The Rifleman with Chuck Connors, and he's the best father on television even today. I count YouTube as television today, where he was always doing the right thing, and he was a single father. His wife died. They don't explain it very much. They don't go into the backstory, but he has a difficult role, but he's always standing up for what is right. So he's not really a bloodthirsty sort of cowboy killing Indians. He's actually doing just the opposite. And it's a very interesting transition where you can see this in the 60s. You can see a lot of writers trying to say, these are modern Westerns. These are not the Westerns of the 1930s even, or the 40s, where we're trying to have a message where we're civilized conquerors. And you can see it in Bonanza. And you know, episodes vary. I mean, I'm not going to say they were all clean like that. But in watching them, the Burt Reynolds character in Gunsmoke is a good example. He was a half-breed. That's what they called him, that. He was half-Cherokee, I think. And it was played by Burt Reynolds. And some of the episodes were... they didn't want him to shoe their horses because they call him a breed, you know, like half breed. So, And that was obviously not acceptable to Marcel Dillon and the main cast of Gunsmoke. So I think there was some transition there in morality and in civics lessons through the Western that I think Tarantino misses a little bit in this film, because he wants to drive this point home that Rick Dalton is this sort of troglodyte, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And besides, he shows a crucial point where Western emigrated to, to Spain and to Italy, and became something else entirely. But yeah, I mean, just the very last thing that I wanted to say on this sort of the moment, 1969. Even when you look at the Oscars, what movies were awarded the Oscars in the season, like 67, 68, 69, you can see the struggle between completely different modes of entertainment. Because in 67, for example, you have In the Heat of the Night wins Best Picture. In 68, John Wayne gets his only Best Actor Oscar for True Grit. And the same year, a completely irrelevant, charming, but irrelevant film like Oliver, the musical, the Dickens musical, gets the Best Picture, which is completely, outside of the whole, let's say, culture war that was going on. And then you have Midnight Cowboy 1 year later. So it's a complete... hothouse sort of cultural change, I would say, that whole period.
And I think that's what he's doing in this film, and it's unstated, but this whole old Hollywood of John Wayne, Gregory Peck, Gary Cooper, Jimmy Stewart, is giving way very reluctantly to not only a new Hollywood of younger people, but also different views, and most of them quite liberal or progressive, whatever term you want to use. That was very evident. You could even see it sometimes at the Oscars when it was televised. They would be segregated, not by politics and by generations, and I think it got quite bitter. In terms of even all through the 70s, it was bitter. I still remember when Coming Home won something, Apocalypse Now and all of the Vietnam films in the late 70s, there was still a sensitive point for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's only 2 years from Jane Fonda winning the Oscar for Clute for Best Performance, and all those politicized speeches that were given at the Oscars throughout the 70s, when Marlon Brando refused his Oscar for one reason, George Siscott refused his Oscar for another reason, then you had all those people. Also, when Vanessa Redgrave got her Oscar, she said some things that criticized the politics of Israel at the time, which is again extremely controversial. But one thing I wanted to ask you about, and this has to draw on your memory, those Western shows, was there already a generation gap in who would watch those shows? Like, would young people watch those, or would it be your dad's generation that would be among the target audience for that?
There's a great anecdote, and we're getting a little bit out of topic here, but Stan Lee talks about this when he was trying to transport Marvel. He says people only cared about Westerns, and I was trying to think of something different, right? So I thought about Spider-Man, and I think that was sort of the if you're making money as a studio on Westerns, you're going to keep making them until you're not making money. And I think that's what they did until the late 60s, when they kind of ran out of gas. I think most of those Westerns started to fall prey to shows like the Mod Squad, Adam 12, these kind of contemporary current event shows. Mod Squad was a diverse cast, Adam 12 dealt with drug issues, even Dragnet. They started going into the modern world, which was more interesting. I think people got tired of looking at the United States in the post-Civil War era and drawing metaphors from that. I think people in the late 60s started to want shows that were topical. Norman Lear, the whole All in the Family. Shows about divorced families, and that was what really killed the Western, I think. Topical shows, the Brady Bunch, Partridge Family, all of those shows were part of this new Hollywood, I think.
But also one of the key figures which actually is still around. I'm thinking of Clint Eastwood, when he sort of transitioned. I mean, he started on Gunsmoke, basically. And then in 1971, you have him in Dirty Harry, in this sort of key, let's say, anti-counterculture film, right? With him basically saying, this is enough, right? We've had it. Like, now, you know, let's sort of start all over again. Do you remember that moment? Because that was 1971 when Dirty Harry opened.
Clint Eastwood was a good example of being a good guy on Rawhide. I think he was on Rawhide. And he was always the dutiful second in command, always doing the right thing. But he went to Fistful of Dollars, and he was a badass, you know. And it was really, you know, just kind of accidental. He bought his poncho somewhere in Santa Monica or something.
He did what Rick Dalton does in this film, right? He went and became a star of Spaghetti Western.
Yeah, and then a few dollars more, and then Good, the Bad, the Ugly. And there you get Tarantino. I think that's where he started to get those influences. Because I would watch those movies on cable, you know, on Sunday afternoon when I was a kid. I'm about his age, so he's a little bit older than me, but I can see where he got that influence. And then, of course, I was thinking about the Tarantino film. They barely show Charles Manson on there. The real heavy is Tex Watson. They make him sort of the guy, the actual guy that did the murders. But in Dirty Harry, where Harry Callahan plays a detective, an inspector who enforces things with a .44 Magnum, mm-hmm. the bad guy in that looks a lot like Charles Manson in the in his mannerisms. And that was the same year the trial was going on. So I don't think that was an accident. I think his name was Chris Robinson, the actor. But he's as evil as you can come, right? He's very sneaky. He lives in San Francisco, which at that time was the hippie capital of the world, and that was the new opposition for the modern vigilante 1970s hero, Death Wish, Charles Bronson, and Clint Eastwood.
Well, there was this, I think, right towards the end of the 60s, that moment when the notion of a truly disturbing occult, almost like evil, like. And that's how we come to also Rosemary's Baby, right? And then Polanski, who is, of course, featured in this film. In terms of amount of detail that Tarantino draws upon in this film, it's incredible. Like, you know, the radio commercials, the songs, the minutiae of everyday life. Did you find yourself recognizing some of the things and the sounds of that era when you were watching the film?
You know, I grew up exactly in this era, and I remember this, and it's, you can't help but being nostalgic, and especially Tarantino, love him or hate him, he has a very, very precise attention to detail. Whether it's when Brad Pitt opens his cupboard, you can see all the brands that you had when you were a child, and Tarantino pays attention to this, and he takes liberties with some things. He invents certain brands, but I think he got the vibe pretty well. I think one of the interesting things is that you know, Brad Pitt's character is not a hipster. He's just a regular guy who listens to Top 40 radio, driving in the car across town. He's not listening to Jimi Hendrix. He's listening to just sort of AM radio, you know, just, and he's happy with it. And I think that was really how most people lived in the early 1970s. People weren't listening to the cool stuff. People were just kind of listening to what made them happy. And you could even see this in the, when Sharon Tate, one of her few lines in the film is, oh, are you worried that Jim Morrison won't think you're cool if you're listening to this corny Top 40 song, you know, to Jay Sebring, you know, so.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great. And also what I loved, there's this fantastic shot in the film, and actually a whole sequence when we see Cliff going back to his trailer. And there's and he lives like like very near to a drive-in theater. So he needs to drive by the drive-in theater. We see the movie being played, and you know there's the oil rigs in the background. It's like the essence of sort of a imaginary California, but maybe also of true California. I mean, you're here to say
that's. I lived in a town called Oildale, and we had We had those oil derricks all throughout my... I'd have to walk to school by those, so those are real. He lived behind the Van Nuys drive-in, which is to say not a fashionable place. And you could see, you know, they exaggerated a little bit. He lived in an Airstream trailer, and he didn't have a very good diet, as you can see, canned food. But mac and cheese and ramen, he combined it. I think it was probably going back to Tarantino's college years, because we all kind of lived that way in some respects. But I think it was a really good character, because he was a very unlikable character on paper, probably. Killed his wife, probably. You know, not easy to work with, all of these things that could be detriments. But I think the script makes him into a good guy with a couple things. One, they give him a dog, and any guy that treats his dog well has got to be a good guy. And that was, I think, the only love story in the film Cliff Booth and his dog, you know. And then, yeah, go ahead.
And very elaborate, because we can see this whole routine that they have, like with him making the dog wait for the food. And actually, Tarantino invented the dog food brand, which is like wolf's tooth. And if you
for the mean dog.
Yes, and if you look closely, I watched the movie twice, so the second time I was just, you know, lingering on details, and you can see the flavors that this dog wolf's tooth come in, and it's rat flavor, bird flavor, and something like raccoon flavor. So that's absurd. And he's making this mac and cheese, you know, like this TV dinner with actually TV playing with all those, you know, like hits and series. But what about, like, how do you remember, because this whole notion of Hollywood, right, magical place, like the glamours, that was also undergoing severe changes at that time, right? I mean, it's not the time of Greta Garbo and, you know, this sort of old-fashioned glamour. Suddenly you had guys like Peter Fonda, may he rest in peace, and Jack Nicholson, who I think is about 90 right now, something like that. But these guys were completely different than the previous generations. What did you think of the way that Tarantino presented this whole of glamorized version of, you know, a Playboy mansion and this whole life that that Margot Robbie and Sharon Tate and Polanski are living in this film, the car ride and stuff.
And you can kind of feel that Rick Dalton feels like he doesn't belong to that. That's what I really saw. Like, he can't go to the Playboy mansion, probably because he's not invited. And because Polanski spins out of the driveway, and if they're going somewhere where old cowboys probably don't feel welcome. There's Steve McQueen, there's Cass Elliott, there's Michelle Phillips, there's who else was there? I mean, it was the hip crowd of 1969 Hollywood, and they even had to have Steve McQueen's character kind of explain things, what's going on.
He looks very much like Steve McQueen.
He does look like Steve McQueen. He does. And Steve McQueen was very much a part of this whole nasty sort of summer, because he was close to all of those people. And I think they do a good job with that. I think they show a good job of Rick Dalton feeling that he's doesn't have a future. I think probably they drive it home when he's reading the dime novel Easy Breezy, you know, that people used to like a cowboy, but now they don't. And the little girl has to tell him, you still got it, and he starts to cry. Cowboys aren't supposed to cry. And but you could see, I think the Spahn Ranch is a metaphor for the decrepit Hollywood. I mean, it doesn't work anymore. Nobody cares about it anymore.
Lena Dunham is one of the hippies, which I thought was the brilliant instance of just malicious casting. You know, yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of Hollywood nepotism in there with the Manson family, you know. But who is there? Dakota Fanning, and there's Annie McDowell's daughter, obviously, plays the pussycat.
And Bruce Dern plays the owner of the ranch, which was interesting. Like, he remembers that time, right? I mean, he starred on some... I mean, he had some supporting roles in some of those Western TV series as well.
If you look at those old series, like Alfred Hitchcock or the old Westerns, Bruce Dern's usually kind of a... heavy, as they say. You know, he's kind of a menacing type of figure. That's how he started out, and it's funny And that was a transition also in the early 60s, you know, this idea where you could have somebody like Robert Mitchum in Cape Fear, you know, this kind of menacing bad guy that's also kind of semi-attractive. And I think there we're getting into the 60s and probably scratching into the whole idea about why people like are attracted to killers, whether they want to admit it or not. You know, one of the things I noticed about this film is Tex Watson went to life in prison. He was supposed to get the death penalty, but they rescinded it in the early 70s. But he's had 4 children while in prison. He's had a very good life in prison. He raised a whole family. He hasn't raised them. Obviously, he can't, you know, spend time with them. But it's an interesting idea about why people are attracted to this sort of sociopathic behavior, and whether it's Darwinistic or not. I'm sure Charles Manson had a lot of fans out there writing him letters, which is kind of sick in a way, but I think it is the reality. And I don't know. You could see women like outlaws. And Charles Manson, one of the things that I think is important, and I don't wish Tarantino would have done it, but he could have done this. Charles Manson was not just a sociopath. He was actually in the recording business. He was making records with the Beach Boys, and they're not terrible. If you listen to him, he sounds like Cat Stevens or Donovan or something like that. And I know this sounds crazy to people who have never listened to these, but his big deal is he wanted a record contract, and he thought he had one. And people thought, here's this guy that's been in jail half his life from Kentucky, but he had something that made people want to follow him, obviously, whether it was charisma or just this something. But he also was talented enough where he got Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys. And the word I heard was that he had a contract to be, you know, the next big thing in the folk music, and he violated his parole, and then Terry Melcher,
Who was Candice Bergen's boyfriend.
And Doris Day's son, which gets weird. But he said, I can't use you anymore, and that was what triggered this whole thing. And they show this in the film a little bit. But they don't explain it that well. But it wasn't just a crazy guy. There were some reasons why he was angry at this
particular
establishment. These guys in particular. I mean, this house.
Do you recall when you know the murders happened? I recently read the Joan Didion's essay, The White Album, and she very firmly locates, like, this was the end of counterculture.
Yeah.
That this sort of killed the dream. She also says something very shocking in her piece, which is that the day after everything, the murders happened, that nobody was surprised, that everyone in this community sort of felt that in a way they were almost like waiting for something as horrific to happen, and it did. So do you remember this early 70s, this sort of the vibe that surrounded counterculture, and how this whole culture shifted into another direction, and how you witnessed it as a kid, basically?
Sure. I was terrified of this in many ways, because I was born, as I said, in 1965, so that meant I was 5 years old when, and I would see this. My sisters were both of this age where they could have been in this. And my oldest sister was 8 years older than me, and she had some parties that I shouldn't have seen the things that I saw. Lots of speed, as I said, amphetamines. I think one of the things that was really dangerous about this period is people that didn't, that shouldn't be taking these kind of drugs did as a habit, and you couldn't have a normal life living like this. And I've actually heard the rumor that was underneath all of the publicity about the Helter Skelter and the whole race war and all of that stuff that was in the public, was that really Manson and Melcher and Dennis Wilson and Tex Watson, they went to these parties all the time. They knew each other. Mm-hmm. And it was the theory that I heard, and I thought Tarantino might go after it, was this was really not really a weird sadistic kind of creepy killing. It was really just a drug deal gone bad, because these guys were all dealing in drugs. They're all in competition with each other, and they had bad drug deals, and this was a vengeance killing. They were going to rob this house. Now, all of that stuff is inside stories, but that was the stuff that was inside the gossip of Hollywood that I think people kind of knew, but they weren't talking about to the national reporters. Like, guys like Steve McQueen knew what was going on, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is of course, you know, a subject of many books. Some of them were published quite recently. There was this recent book that was immediately translated into Polish as well. It's called Chaos, Charles Manson and the Secret History of 60s by Tom O'Neill, who spent 20 years researching the subject. And the book is fascinating. I'm reading it right now. And of course, you know, we always have to take it with a grain of salt. But he's a respectable author. I mean, yeah. He was, you know, interviewed by New York Times about this book and stuff, and he says that yes, I mean, Manson was part of that whole milieu, and he also suggests that the CIA was actually closely watching what Manson was doing. It wasn't like suddenly out of the blue there was this completely, you know, unexpected killing. They were actually watching him quite closely, and the book makes a number of interesting points like that, but it tells you that it's not necessarily the story that, for example, Helter Skelter said, that there was this, you know, demonic possessed guy and that's it, you know.
What I get out of this, and I did read, is this the guy that had a 6-week deadline and ended up taking 20 years to
that's
do
him,
it?
That's
yeah.
Him.
Okay, I read about this guy. Uh-huh. I didn't read his book, but I read about him, and it was fascinating that the guy says, I just kept going down these rabbit holes and they really bothered me and I didn't know how I was going to finish this. And for me, and listen, I don't want to, because Charles Manson gave me nightmares when I was a kid. I would read these things and kids would talk about him on the playground. It was the scariest guy ever. But once you start looking at this kind of stuff, that see, he was part of this culture. He wasn't a guy out in Spawn Ranch. He was actually going to these parties. He was actually hanging out with Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys, the biggest band in the world. And Dennis Wilson was trying to get him a contract, and so was Terry Melcher. These are big stars. This wasn't a guy who was just on the fringe. And I think they kind of whitewashed that after the trial, because nobody wanted to say, yeah, I was the guy that said, sign this guy. You know, and I think in those days, in 1971, it was easier to just bury stuff. You could just say, hey, we didn't say that. You never read it here. Mm-hmm. And there's only the, you know.
There were no tweets to be saved, you know. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that O'Neill says in his book, and it's a very interesting book, and he doesn't make any wild claims. I mean, it's not like this crazy conspiracy book. It's just, you know, he says very clearly that many people who were involved somehow refused to talk to him. Like Warren Beatty, for example, won't say a word about all this until today. So it seems there are some stuff that they are simply don't want to even touch. And he, you know, he did some very interesting research. So, and I think that also speaks to this whole moment in culture of Hollywood. You know, the doors were unlocked. You know, people were walking in freely into all those mansions, and basically they were open to all kinds of very extreme experiences that somehow also, you know, spilled into terrible excess.
And one of the stories, I mean, these stories that it was just a bad drug deal and guys were angry at each other, so they went in on speed and started killing each other, makes more sense in a way than the whole Helter Skelter theory that you have to really believe in a lot of weird things. Like, Manson was not a stupid guy. If you hear him talk, you know, the guy grew up in prison. He's one of those weird American stories where he grew up in Appalachia and made his way out to San Francisco and L.A. But if you hear him talk, he's got, you know, you don't get into that whole high Hollywood culture by being a hick from Appalachia. He had something where he got in there. And if you listen to his songs, he's got one. The Beach Boys covered one of his songs. And I always heard that was why he was really angry at Dennis Wilson, because he never paid him for it. He gave him a motorcycle or something, and Manson was really angry about that. And you never hear those stories in the pop culture. In the LA Times, you never read it. It was always about this ritualistic slaying. But maybe it was just simple envy, jealousy, drug deals gone bad, guys giving some guys bad mescaline, and I always heard Frykowski was involved in this with Folger. She was funding his... He was a drug dealer, and, you know, in all of the stories you hear, they were just fringe kind of players. But the story I heard is that Tex Watson was coming to get him because he sold him some bad merchandise. But you don't get that because it's not based on Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate was not supposed to be there. That's the story I always heard in the... locker room, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, O'Neill also speaks about that, about Frykowski being a drug dealer, and there's a number of details that definitely, and you know, this is something I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that, you know, the whole helter-skelter ideology and the fact that it was basically, you know, the only possible way to speak of all those, occurrences, that it was, you know, this crazy occult ideology. But it may be that it's much more mundane, I would say. It became an incredible fodder for mass imagination, popular imagination, of course, the Helter Skelter, because it's, you know, like, it's almost like Rosemary's Baby, you know, exactly. this occult, paranoid narrative. But I mean, O'Neill's book certainly makes you think and makes you look for much more mundane and, I would say, human, not necessarily, you know, superhuman or otherworldly explanations.
People were frightened, and I think if there was no politics in this film, you know, one of the things that was interesting is that Ronald Reagan was the governor at the time. And he was very involved in this, very vocal, talking about, you know, you can go on YouTube now and look at Ronald Reagan talking about LSD in the most technical terms, but he doesn't really know what it is because nobody knew what it was. It was very new. Richard Nixon is the president, and he actually comments directly on this, that the media is making Charles Manson into a hero, and that's bad, and they shouldn't do that. So this was a very political case, and Tarantino stayed away from that.
That's true. I think that the only piece of political coverage is when they're literally two sentences on the Vietnam War going on the radio, and then I think he switches to a song. So that's it. Okay, so slowly let's move to the ending of the movie. When you were walking in and seeing the film for the first time, did you know about the big twist at the end, let's say, or was that come as a surprise?
I did not know. I deliberately didn't read any reviews, and I was kind of dreading, in a way, that something was going to ruin this. This kind of was a buddy picture, and I'm not saying I loved the picture, and I'm not saying I hated it. But I watched it the second time, and I saw more things. So when the ending came, probably like everybody else in the theater, I was wondering how they're going to figure this one out. What's going to happen here? And you know, it was a Tarantino technique. You know, you get a villain like the Nazis and Inglourious Basterds or the KKK, and
Django.
Yeah, and Django, or somebody that nobody can sympathize with, and then you just, you know, distribute justice. And I think that they did it in a humorous way. Nobody was going to stand up for Susan Atkins, for example. But it was kind of weird. I mean, I had... It was a little excessive, but it was humorously done in a Tarantino way. That's all I can say.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because I unfortunately knew that was my big mistake, that I went online before and I read that, but I sort of expected that, you know, knowing Inglourious Basterds. But well, Tarantino, he is quite vocal in saying that this will be his, I mean, the next film will be his last. He wants to make 10 films, and that's it. And I wonder what will be the next one. But maybe let's end the conversation with the question of how did you first become aware of Tarantino, and what did he represent to you when he started out in the 90s? Like, did you feel that here is this new, wind sort of blowing, like a new force in the culture? And were you happy about it, or were you apprehensive?
I, you know, one of the things that was good about the Cliff Booth character was that he wasn't taking the world seriously. There's a scene where Pussycat is hitchhiking, and she sees a policeman, and she goes, "Go to hell, pig," and she flips him the bird, and Cliff just laughed at it, and he didn't take her seriously as a revolutionary, which is the biggest insult you can give somebody as a revolutionary, just laugh at them. And I think this is a big theme of that film. As far as how I felt about it, you asked me earlier, I come from a pretty big family, but I'm the youngest of these generations, and I had a cousin that went to Vietnam, and he's still alive, and he's the last person in his squad that is still alive. And I had a cousin who was very popular girl at school, almost like Laura Palmer, who died in a car crash, and it really impacted me and the family in general, by extension, just by that the world is scary out there. And her grandmother was F. Scott Fitzgerald's sister, so it was kind of a big thing in California the year before this. Her name was Cecilia, and there was a Simon and Garfunkel song called Cecilia at the same time. And my aunt completely went bonkers, and I didn't know this until I was much older. But this idea of losing children from Iowa or Missouri, going away to evil California, was very much in the bloodstream of 1967, the Summer of Love, because that could be a good thing or it could be a nightmare. So when Tarantino came out with Reservoir Dogs, I saw that in San Francisco. I thought it was a really good film. I didn't know who made it. I just said, this is a very interesting film. But it bothered me in some ways, because I still remember in San Francisco when they was going to burn Tim Roth's character with gasoline, the crowd started to cheer. And in 1992, when I saw this, I started to sense sort of a cultural change. There was Thelma and Louise that came out the year before. And Tarantino was part of this new kind of cynicism. And it made me nervous. And I'm just speaking off the cuff here. I remember when Pulp Fiction came out, it bothered me that was no longer the counterculture. This was pop culture. People wanted to see this film. It was on NPR. It was on CNN. It was everywhere.
Golden Palm at Cannes.
A very cynical film. And it worried me that we're going back to this period that I wanted to kind of put behind me, and that sort of chaotic libertine era that I remember when I was a kid. It was scary. It really was scary. And that was the year of the O.J. Simpson murder, which was the closest thing, at least in terms of publicity, since the Manson, or the whatever you want to call them, the Tex Watson murders. And for me, I thought Tarantino introduced a new period of cynicism in the 90s. This idea of nothing really matters except sort of hip music and violence. And I don't know if he got away with it, but that's how I thought about that. Natural Born Killers bothered me. Remember, there was a TV show called My So-Called Life, where a girl had a pretty good, at least materialistically, upbringing with two good parents, and she still wasn't happy. Mm. And it bothered me. And that was the same time as The Simpsons and all of that. So it's a long answer. Sorry.
Right. No. That's fine. There was certainly this air of, let's say, renewed irony in the beginning of the 90s. I think that this film, I mean, I like it a lot. The new film, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, also. But I think it's a complicated film. I mean, it's contradictory in many, many ways. What I find interesting is this sort of reinstatement of this character of Cliff, who makes me think of a character that I know that is important for both you and me, which actually I became aware of because of you, which is Jim Rockford, the character played by James Garner on The Rockford Files, a terrific TV series that I watched thanks to you. A 1970s series. He's also living in a trailer. He has this sort of, I would say, detached decency about him. I mean,
great term.
So would you like finish by commenting on Rockford, and maybe even some of the people listening to it will discover Rockford thanks to this.
Rockford Files is my favorite show ever, and I would be surprised if it wasn't also Tarantino watching this in the 1970s on Friday nights, because we did watch this. But I didn't really get Rockford until years later in syndication when I was, you know, much older. And Rockford is this sort of jaded guy who doesn't want to do the right thing, but at the end he always does the right thing, even if he doesn't really want to do the right thing. He's always got friends that get him into trouble. Angel.
Stuart Margolin.
And I think the Brad Pitt character was kind of based on him. He lived in a trailer. He didn't really want to help, but he would help out kind of by accident. And I think it was a really interesting character. Probably the biggest thing that people are talking about is that he beat up Bruce Lee, or at least, you know, it was an image in his head. I think he was one of the a man that we don't see anymore in film, a man that gets things done. Rockford was always getting things done. Rockford could get things done. You got a problem, he'll fix it. I think now modern men, they don't put a value on this. They call somebody to fix their problems. And you could see Brad Pitt's character. There's no app to go fix, you know, Rick Dalton's antenna. He's got to go do it with tools himself, and he knew how to do it. When I was a kid going to grade school, I still have my report card somewhere. I had auto shop, metal shop, wood shop, mechanical drawing. We had all of those trades that you had to learn, and just you had to learn how to do this stuff because that was the world at that time. They were afraid. There weren't enough desk jobs for us. And I think Cliff Booth was that kind of guy. He was a war hero. They imply it by saying you're Audie Murphy, which is a cinematic reference, but he was also charismatic. He was just a guy who didn't think it was a big deal to go fix an antenna. He just did it. While drinking 10 Bloody Marys and, you know.
Right.
And he was a man's man. I really like this guy. And I don't think you're supposed to like him. And I could see Tarantino, the Bruce Lee, because people are going to ask that. But go ahead.
Right. No, I'm just saying that there's also this dark secret that he has, or dark past, because we don't know if he killed his wife or not, which I think was completely unnecessary in the movie, because actually when I read the interview with Tarantino in the latest Sight and Sound, I know why that piece of a puzzle doesn't really fit into the movie, is because Tarantino based it on a short story that he wrote about Cliff years ago, and he wanted somehow to incorporate that into the film. I don't think it really works for the character. I don't know what's the point of putting it there. But what I love about Cliff as well is that he's a driver for Rick Dalton.
Yeah.
Rick cannot drive after this drunken incident that he had, so now he has to drive him. And there's this sort of like dependency, which I liked a lot. And even in the commercials that Cliff is listening to on the radio, which was, you know, commonplace at the time, but I loved listening to those commercials because some of them were pretty crazy, like the Tanya Sunning butter, you know. But the funny thing is that they would tell the truth in the commercial. Like the guy on the radio says, "Oh, Tanya Tanning butter is fantastic." Well, it may get you burned a little, but that doesn't matter. And nowadays you wouldn't hear something like that in a commercial, you know. I mean, it's all just this facade of media lies, you know.
I think also getting back, and I guess before we depart, we should talk about, I mean, there's two big parts we didn't talk about with the Booth character, the Brad Pitt character. One is the Spahn Ranch, where he goes there and he does some frontier justice on one of the Manson clan, you know, this weird guy, Clem Grogan, who is involved in the Tate LeBianca, I think, murders. But he does something that reminded me of a famous picture. I had a friend who used to tell me that there's two kinds of men in American cinema, and you need both of them to have a society survive. One of them, and they're both in the man who shot Liberty Valance, you know. And there's this great line where Liberty Valance knocks over Jimmy Stewart and the stake falls on the ground. And John Wayne says, "Pick up that stake, Liberty." And Lee Marvin's character is the most vicious guy you could imagine as a character. He says, "I'm not going to pick up that stake." And he goes, "Pick up that stake." And he does. And it reminded me of when Cliff Booth says, fix that tire, fix that tire. And the guy says, I'm not going to fix it. And he says, you're going to fix it. And he does. And it's a little bit of a weird scene because people don't really know who this guy is, I think, unless you really know the Manson sort of family tree. But the fact that he took this guy and just crushed his face and he bloodied his face and he fixed his tire said something. Also, beating up Bruce Lee, I could see Tarantino at a party saying, how do we make this guy the complete badass in 30 seconds? Hey, how about having him beat up Bruce Lee? Why not? You know, like, or at least a draw, you know, like, so I thought it was a good character. It was a fun movie to watch. I think it's a weird movie to say that you enjoyed because it's such a serious subject. But, yeah.
Well, the final thing I would say is that I was very apprehensive when I read that. Unfortunately, it leaked, so I read the big twist. But I was apprehensive. I thought it was extremely, I mean, distasteful, to say the least. You know, I'm probably wrong to do that. But then, you know, when I watched the movie, I think that he actually, you know, he pulled it off. And the fact that also Sharon Tate's sister, Deborah, sort of accepted this portrayal of her sister on the screen. She even lent Tarantino some of Sharon's actual jewelry, which Margot Robbie wears in the film, because she trusted Tarantino and she accepted the portrayal. Although it did become controversial, the portrayal of Margot Robbie, I mean the portrayal of Sharon Tate and the way Margot Robbie plays her and the way Tarantino wrote her. Maybe some final thoughts on that, on Sharon in the film.
You know, I heard that, and that was one thing I read going in, because you remember that Tarantino got the question at a press conference. She doesn't have many lines. I thought she did a wonderful job of portraying somebody on the ascent of her career. She's a good person. She's doing the right thing. She's happy about her life. And she gives a positive image to what Dalton keeps saying, those hippies. She's kind of a hippie, but she's a happy hippie. She's reading, she's happy, she's nice to everybody, she's cheerful about life. You can see her eyes light up. She's happy to be alive. And I think she picks up a hitchhiker, and it's a good hitchhiker, and she says, good luck in Big Sur. I hope, you know, you can see, and that was optimistic. It showed you, by absence of her getting killed, what we lost. And maybe, you know, Rick Dalton's obviously on the other end of his career, but I love at the end, and I don't want to give it away, but sure, but she's just saying, hey, come on up and just let's have a drink, you know, you're my neighbor, and it's so nice, and it's so different than the menacing spirit of the previous 20 minutes.
I completely agree, and I think that film has a very particularly good vibe at the end, and that vibe made me think of another film from the period, which we didn't mention, and I don't see Tarantino mentioning it a lot in the interviews, but I'm thinking of like early 70s Robert Altman's, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, The Long Goodbye, you know, especially The Long Goodbye with all those shots of LA. There was this good vibe in those films, you know, of people enjoying each other's company. MASH is a different example, but still, I mean, it was nice to see that humanity shine through, especially in her character. I love the scene with the hitchhiker because it showed her being generous to people.
She was being nice, and she was reading, and she obviously loved Polanski. I mean, if you read about their real relationship, it's probably more complicated than they made it in the film. They didn't really dive into that. They didn't. But you know, she's buying tests, you know, the which he would make 10 years later and say, you know, and she's just happy to be doing what she's doing. And the film, the part of the film where she goes and watches herself play opposite Dean Martin, and she gets such a kick out of that people actually like her, and she looks like she's really nervous whether they will like her or not, you know. And I love that character, and I didn't know if I would like it or not. And I thought it was just well played. I think the thing that also is important about this film is there was a joke inside of the joke that I think Tarantino is also saying goodbye to the early 90s stars of, you know, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, Thelma and Louise, where Brad Pitt came out.
Sure.
You even saw...
Michael Madsen is there for a second.
And you saw... there are a couple of 90210 stars in there that were... Luke Perry, where nobody knew that was going to be his last role. So yeah. I thought it was good, and you know... Movies are movies. I was nervous, as I said, about making a movie about Manson because I don't want to glamorize this stuff. I hate it. I hate when they glamorize even Scorsese. I didn't, you know, Henry Hill, if you know anything about this guy in real life, right, in Goodfellas, he was a terrible guy. He was a mean guy, vicious guy. And Ray Liotta shined him up to make it like he was this nice guy. And I think they had to do that in The Godfather as well. And I didn't want to see them do that to this family. And I don't think they did. I think they made kind of a regular guy the hero. Just a regular stuntman who nobody really liked him except Rick.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a good call, you know.
Same here, and I think that even the choice of the profession for Cliff, which is the stuntman, that also bespeaks this nostalgia, because it is a profession that sort of is dying out because of CGI. You can have anyone do anything on the screen, and you don't even need those daring... I mean, of course, there are still stuntmen, but it's not the same thing, you know. When you see those stunts in the old movies, you know they did that. You know? There's no way around it. And here, so I like that aspect of it too.
And I think you know you're a movie buff, so you know, but Burt Reynolds, I think, is really Tarantino's hero. And he was growing up, Burt Reynolds was the guy, like in Deliverance you mentioned, but he was also in a movie called Hooper, yeah. And I think that was kind of a mirror image of this film, you know, like the stuntman as the leading man. And I'll be interested to see if Pitt gets nominated for...
I do hope that they both do, and Margot Robbie should probably get supporting that. Burt Reynolds was supposed to play the owner of the farm, but he died, so Bruce Dern took over. But yes, Tarantino speaks at length about his friendship with Burt Reynolds, and it seems that, you know, it's been a while since we had any films focused on the stuntman like Hooper or the stuntman from the 80s, in which Steve Railsback, the Manson of Helter Skelter, played the stuntman. So yeah, I like that aspect of it too. It's sort of like, it's nostalgia.
And it was melancholy when he says, you know, I will tell you, I think we talked about this earlier, where I saw it the first time and I missed a lot of stuff, and I watched it the second time and I was by myself almost in the theater. It was in middle of the day and it was maybe four or five other people in there. But there's a lot of melancholy there, where he says, "Hey, I'm back from Italy, and I can't use you anymore." And you know, Cliff just says, "Hey, sounds good, no problem." But you can tell that that's the end of a partnership. It's almost like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid type of thing, where we got to go our separate ways. And I think that it worked. I think that those guys were likable characters without being superheroes. Although I did see, I don't know if you noticed this, but I said this is the first movie in a long time where it's not a Marvel type of thing, but you can see when Brad Pitt gets up on the roof, he does a Spider-Man hop.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I believe that might have been some CGI involved, so that brings it full circle, you know?
Yeah, but I thought of him in Thelma and Louise with this, you know, where he started out as sort of an unknown, nobody knew who he was, and he kind of stole the show. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's time goes fast, man, you know, and he still looks good. And I think Brad Pitt is one of those guys you appreciate more when he does these kind of roles. So I thought he was good in Moneyball for the same reason. He just has this dignity about him that is, when he's trying to play the leading man, he doesn't really have it. I think he was just being a casual guy here, and he's got that. Mm-hmm. So, but,
yeah, and the film is eerily well-timed, I would say, because the fact that this is the 50th anniversary exactly at the time of the release, and the weird timing of Peter Fonda's death, you know, the Easy Rider, who died like literally weeks after this film opened. So it does feel like an end of an era, or at least a goodbye to some notion of that era that's still with us, as it turns out.
And I think, you know, I had mixed feelings about Tarantino in the early 90s because I thought he was bringing in this unnecessary sort of fashionable cynicism in Natural Born Killers, for example. Oh, that was his script, I think. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But I think that we should be thankful that a guy came along that had this kind of appreciation for history, not just of American cinema, but international cinema, and he put it into his scripts where people had to go back and look at things. And I think in 1992 there was no YouTube, there was no, you know, there's no internet. And we are thankful that there was a guy who had a job at a video store that took that much appreciation in his films. Even if he got accused of ripping them off, he brought them to an attention of a generation that would have never known those films.
Yeah. That's why at some point I even named him a curator. Like, he's almost like a curator of a big film museum, because he really, I mean, he unearthed some stars, some films that people wouldn't care about, but he, simply by mentioning them or by casting them, like Pam Grier, I mean, how many people remembered Pam Grier in 1997? He cast her in a major role, and you know, she had a wonderful star performance. So
people remember the Travolta, but Tarantino remembers the summer of 1978 like I do, where John Travolta had Grease and Saturday Night Fever,
Welcome Back Cotter,
but then he went into Urban Cowboy and even Blowout, and then his career faded. It goes fast, and he was in Look Who's Talking or whatever.
He had so many bad movies in the 80s. The Two of Us, The Perfect.
Perfect was terrible.
Some very bad movies.
The sequel to Saturday Night Fever was terrible.
Staying Alive, that's one of the worst.
Ask you a question, sure, maybe? Sure. What did you think about the portrayal of Polanski?
Oh, well, that's a fair question. Apart from the hype that was all over Polish media, because, you know, Rafał Zawierucha was on every possible breakfast TV show, I think it was actually nice. I mean, I like that, you know, he didn't have any lines. I'm sure Rafał Zawierucha is not happy about that. I mean, he was probably hoping for a bigger turn. But he looked eerily like Polanski. And in the movements, you know, I loved, I'm not sure who did the costumes for this film, but I love this sort of like modern era dandy look that he had, you know, with those shirts and this whole look when they are going to a party. I like that he cast a guy who's actually also diminutive, so when he's standing next to Sharon Tate, like, you can see he's a very tiny, tiny guy, and you can definitely sense this air of just being happy about himself in terms of, like, he's a big shot at this point, and probably not the nicest person to be around. So I like that about it. How about you?
I liked it. I was surprised in a way that he didn't have any lines, but I thought that was the same with Sharon Tate. You know, everybody knew who they were in spirit. They didn't need to be complicated characters. He had a dog named Saperstein, which was funny, and that's in character, right? And I thought that was a nod to just reality.
Apparently, it was actually the name of the dog.
It was. And I like that Rick Dalton said, that's the most important director in the world living right next to me, you know. So he had this idea that, hey, Polanski, I think for a bunch of kids these days, they don't know that he was the most important director in the world. And they said it, you know, right out of the Texas, or he's from Missouri, Rick Dalton, which is where Brad Pitt was from. I remember I remember at the end he says, I got to go back to Missouri and just be a nobody. I bet that was so. But it was good. I'm happy generally in the film. I'm happy it was made and it wasn't glamorizing this terrible, destructive, nasty, evil sort of deed. And there was a happy ending out of it. And I think that if you haven't seen the film, if I say it's a happy ending, it's not that happy. But it's for me, I enjoyed.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming up on the show, and it was wonderful to talk the movie with you. So hopefully you're not last appearance here. Thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure, Michal. We go back a long ways, and I hope I didn't talk too much about this, because I, you know, that's my job, you know. So
it was great. Thank you so much.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let me just.